This is interview number 18. This is Edward Applebaum, and I'm speaking with Donald Roberts on Thursday, August 15th, 1985. We are beginning this interview at 10:35 in the morning. We are about to interview Mr. Roberts about his immigration experience from Wales in 1925. Mr. Roberts, could you tell us a little bit about where and when you were born and what life was like in your native country of Wales?
Well, I was born in a mining village in Wales in April of 1913. The First World War was about to erupt, but of course I had no knowledge of that at the time, except that as time went on, we became very cognizant of some of the things that were happening. For example, food was very short, and we as small kids used to rummage in the street for anything we could find, like a piece of orange skin or anything like that. And the village, as most of the other places there in the country, had allotted by the government a certain amount of ground where people could grow a limited amount of vegetables. So that's the way we survived. And I remember as a young boy going to school to be covered with a lot of sores on the surface of the skin, which my mother would put some kind of an ointment on, and we thought nothing of it. We thought this was just part and parcel of growing up and living, but of course it was due to malnutrition. So the war took a terrible toll in Britain of the men, because there was such a slaughter that even I think exceeded in some ways the casualties of the Second World War. But after the war was over, my father, who was a captain in the forces, decided that he should try to come to America to better the lot of the family. He had been employed prior to the war as a small building contractor, and he had carried on that business, and at the same time he and another man owned a funeral service, which seems to be a very strange thing, but in those days these kind of things happen. So my father left home and came to America, and left my mother and myself, my younger brother and two younger sisters, so that he could sort of pave the way for us to come to America. We were put on a quota list, and our name never seemed to come up to be allowed to come. My father was in this country for about 3 or almost 4 years. He had bought a house in the meanwhile on Staten Island and waiting for us to come, but we never could get through the rigmarole of the red tape. So my father came back and decided that was it. But after he was back for a while and he saw what the conditions were again there, and the prodding from my mother, who was interested to come too, our name finally came up on the quota list, and they sold the house, the furniture, packed some things in some wooden boxes, and off we went to Southampton, which was where the ship left. The ship was the Aquitania, and we left, as far as I remember, the latter part of April or early part of May, and we took 7 days to arrive in New York.
Do you remember what your feelings were about leaving Wales?
Well, the feelings were mixed. Leaving my friends, I was 12 years old at the time. But coming to a new country excited us as kids. We had mixed emotions because we're coming to a new country, not knowing what was ahead of us, but I think the excitement overwhelmed the other thoughts we might have, and it wasn't until we were here a while that we realized what a big break we had made, and we became very homesick.
What had you heard about the United States before coming over?
Well, the only thing we had heard was that economic conditions were much better in this country. There was an opportunity for people to advance themselves more rapidly than you could in Britain. The opportunities there were very limited. The weather wasn't all that good. And so these were the things, but I think particularly the economic aspect of it was what motivated my parents to want to better our lot. So we came across. Now, my recollections of the trip over on the ship was very crowded. We had picked up in Cherbourg a lot of people from Southern Europe and Middle Europe, and this was our first contact with what we call foreigners. The ship, of course, the Cunard ship, was a British ship, and we had no problem there. But the ship was very crowded with people. We had a small cabin for the six of us, and we managed pretty good. We were restricted where we could go, naturally, because we weren't in the first or second class. We were in the third class passage. And we used to go out on the after deck of the vessel for air, and people, of course, were lying around any place they could find to stay out in the open air rather than get back into the stifling conditions inside the ship. But all in all, my recollections of the passage were fine. There's one very interesting aspect that I will always remember was a horse that was being carried over from Europe, which happened to be the famous horse Tony. He was the horse of Tom Mix, the movie star. Now, when we were kids in Wales, we could go to the cinema, usually on a Saturday afternoon, and watch the cowboy pictures. And of course, there'd be a hero and another guy with a black hat. And I can remember some of us kids, these would be serials, you know, when you come to a certain exciting point, it was continued next week. So you couldn't wait until next week to go back and see what was going to happen. But sometimes we would throw things at the screen if we didn't like the guy that was doing whatever. So Tom Mix was always the hero. He and another fellow named Dustin Farnham and a couple other people that I can't remember the names of now, but these were the heroes. And Tom Mix's horse Tony was, I guess, what Trigger would be in the later generation. And they used to bring this horse out on the deck and let him walk around and get a little exercise, because they had him in a big wooden box on the rear deck. And some of us kids had our picture taken on Tony's back, but those pictures are gone. I don't know what happened to them, but they're in my memory anyway. So we arrived in New York. And
is there anything else you can say about the trip over? Did you keep your food down?
Yes.
What were the spirits of your family?
Yes. The voyage wasn't rough. There wasn't any problem in that area. There were certain restrictions we had, like I remember my father had to make an arrangement with the bath steward for us to be able to take one or two baths along the way. They had to be regimented that way, you know. We didn't have any for somebody other than the small cabin we were in. But that was okay. There was no problem there. And we had been living not under austere conditions in Wales, but we weren't used to any luxuries, so it didn't bother us that way.
And what was your impression of seeing people from other countries?
Well, I was bewildered, and I was afraid of them, and I tried to stay away from them as much as I could, because they were entirely different type of people. Some of them were dressed very shabbily and spoke languages that didn't mean anything to us, and they were a different breed of people, you might say, so we didn't associate with them. We just had any contacts with English-speaking people. So we arrived in New York Harbor, and we had a cursory medical examination right there on the ship.
Can you tell me what you remember, if anything, about coming into the harbor itself? What time of year was it?
It was in early May. And the ships at that time used to stop at a quarantine, which was in the outer harbor before you came into the Narrows. And all the ships used to stop there, and they used to put up the quarantine flag, the yellow flag, and until the ship was cleared to come into the inner harbor. So I'm familiar with that, because later on I was in the American Merchant Marine, so I know something about that, but that didn't mean anything to me at the time. So there was an awful lot of confusion there. People all lined up and getting a very sketchy examination, but the result of that examination required us to be transported to Ellis Island. My mother was taken away and isolated in a hospital area because she was suspected of having tuberculosis. So my father and us four kids were kept in a separate area along with all the other people who were there for various reasons, weren't being allowed to come in to the country without some kind of a problem. So my father and us kids were given what I would consider now VIP treatment, because we were put into a very small little room, and we lived in that room. There were just a few bunks in there, and we weren't in with all the other people that were milling around. It was just like a zoo there. What I remember about it, the place smelled of disinfectant, like the hospitals used to. There was a man that came around every morning and every afternoon, by 10 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, with a stainless steel cot, sort of like a Good Humor cot. And the man was dressed in white, and he had the warm milk for the kids. And they would blow a whistle or ring a bell, and all the kids would line up, and he had small little paper cups, and he had a dipper, and every kid got a little milk, warm milk. So that was one thing that sticks in my mind. Another thing is that we were, in order to have some kind of system, I suppose, everything had to be done by the numbers. They would blow a whistle or signify in some other way. Sometimes it would beat a gong when it was time for meals. And we would then walk down these, seemed to me, endless corridors, all with white tile on the sides, and down and around, and finally we come into a big hall. And this big hall had long wooden tables and benches. And the waiters would come out and put the food on the table. And that was really something. I can remember especially the breakfast, because that shook us up every day we were there. The breakfasts were invariably eggs. And the eggs were cooked in big wire baskets. And they would bring these wire baskets and set them on the table. And before they'd be on the table, these people, these Southern Europeans and whatever, we thought they were savages because they acted like that. They'd be grabbing these eggs and breaking them open, and the egg yolk would be running down their faces. And we were brought up to wait until everybody was ready to eat, and so on. And we just couldn't adjust to that situation. You know, it was a bizarre thing. I really was shocked. And even when I think of it now, I say, my goodness, it gives me the shivers sometimes to think of. And they would take bread almost from under your nose and snatch the stuff away from you. And it was very, very bad experience. Not that we went hungry. We ate somewhere along the line, but that was some substance of what our table etiquette was and what we had to put up with. Then every day they had an assembly of people who were all marched into a big hall, and there they would announce those who were being released into the country, and those who were going to be still detained, and those who were going to be deported. And you can imagine what went on there, the screaming and the hollering, and it was something.
Who would make those announcements?
Well, the officials were up on a platform, and these people would all be segregated then, by category, if they were going into the country or whatever.
Do you remember which room it was in?
It was a great big hall.
It was the great hall.
It was a big room, a great big place. Looked like a railway station almost, you know. Now, during the days that we were waiting there, we would be let out in the morning and the afternoon for an hour or so to get some exercise in the yard. And the yard had a high fence, about 15 feet high, a wire fence. And once in a while we could look across the way and we could see my mother at the window of the hospital. It was, I guess it was about 5 or 6 stories high, something like that, the building there. And she would wave to us kids and my father. And of course we could see everything going on in the harbor. And that's how the days went by.
You could see the Statue of Liberty each day?
Yeah, of course, yeah. See, because, you know, that's very close to...
Right.
So the days went by, and ultimately my mother was released. She had no tuberculosis, but she had always suffered with bronchitis. And she had that as long as I can remember her. And My mother died at 89, not too many years ago, and that is what killed her. But anyway, that was the reason for her being.
Other than looking across the water towards her, you didn't see her for the entire 2 weeks?
No. Once in a great while, we'd always look up at the windows, you see, and I guess she must have known when we would be let out, and because there was a time schedule, it wasn't a haphazard thing. And we would see her waving at the window at a long distance away, you know. We couldn't see her cloak. So my father took care of us kids. And when the day came that we were allowed to come into the country, that was a real banner day.
Did you realize there was a possibility you would be sent back?
Of course. My father had prepared us for that. And that must have been a very traumatic thing for people who actually were sent back, because if they cut off their ties like we had, my father had sold all the furniture, sold the house. There was nothing to go back to start over again. But of course, with all the people that were trying to come into the country, there were people with criminal records and whatnot. They had to sort the wheat from the chaff, I guess, as best they could. So there were many people who were sent back. I don't know how many, but there were quite a few, I know, because every day there was this commotion going on.
Did you or your brothers and sisters make any friends while you were on the island for those 2 weeks?
No. We kept to ourselves. We were very glad to have this little hole to stay in and not get involved with these other people, because we didn't fit. So
there weren't other English-speaking people at the time on the island?
There must have been, but not that I was aware of. The by far the predominant number of people were from Central Europe or Southern Europe, dressed in was very strange clothes, and whatever manners they had didn't certainly jive with what we were accustomed to.
Were there any social services that you can remember?
No, I don't remember any such thing. The only amenity that I can remember is having the milkman come around with his warm milk. And he had a stainless steel cot. When people were allowed to come into the country, they were designated to go through a certain area. You were sort of channeled in certain ways. And there was no way of sneaking out or breaking into anything. It was an orderly sort of arrangement. So we all went down through this wide-in area and got on a ferry boat. And the ferry boat ran back and forth from there to the Battery. And then we just walked off, just like letting the birds out of the cage.
If I can back you up for 1 second, do you remember the announcement being made that it was okay for your family to leave?
No, I don't specifically remember that, but of course it didn't come as a surprise, like in 5 minutes you had to leave, because you had to have time to collect your belongings and so on. I would imagine that it was for the following day or something like that, but I have no firm recollection about that. But we had an advantage, several advantages in entering the country. First of all, we had no language barrier. Secondly, my father, having lived in, worked in New York and lived on Staten Island for 3 or 4 years, he was familiar with the area. So we went up to 23rd Street to the a hotel called the Cornish Arms Hotel. And it was still there many years later. It might still be there. It's on 23rd Street, I think, between 7th and 8th Avenue or somewhere in that area. So the Cornish Arms was a place where the British people went, obviously. And so I, being the oldest, had to ride herd on the other kids while my father and mother went to look for a place to live. And they went by ferry across to Jersey City, got on the train. The first stop was Rutherford. They got off in Rutherford agent. Right across the street was a real estate agent. They walked in there. He took them for a ride down the street, and they bought a house. So this didn't happen just overnight. I think we were there about a week or something like that at the hotel. So we came over to Rutherford. The real estate man took us in his car to the empty house without a stick of furniture in the house, and there we were. We arrived in the afternoon, I remember very clearly. It was in, I guess, the end of May, the early part of June. And a couple of the neighbor ladies came in and offered us some tea or something like that. And my parents had to go right out to the hardware store and buy some cups and saucers. And so we started off really from scratch. We slept on the floor that night. And now here we were, strangers in a strange land. We were dressed like British kids with short pants, rosy cheeks, and we must have stood out like a sore thumb, because it didn't take very long, a few weeks before kids used to gang up on us and try to beat us up because we were the outcasts, you know. When I look back now and I think of people who were real foreigners, they didn't know the language or anything like that, they had to contend with that on top of other discrimination. Many a times we used to run home and just make it home before this gang of kids would catch us. My father, amongst other things, when he was a young man, was a boxer. And he, I have records in the house now of him running a boxing team for people in the army and cadets who were coming into the armed forces.
This was in the British Army.
In the British Army. From this little area where we lived in Wales, his outfit went to the Championship of Wales, Championship of Britain, and I have the cuttings in the house somewhere. And they just lost out, but they came in second out of this whole team competition. So my father was handy with his fist. So he bought my brother and I a set of boxing gloves, and he said, "We're going to go in the backyard, and I'm going to teach you how to defend yourself, because you're not going to be running home every day." So my brother and I used to go at it, and I think we roughed ourselves up more than any of the kids that... Well, to make a long story short, after a while we got sorted out, and we gave as much as we got, and after a while we were left alone. But to compound that, the first year we were here, this place was alive with mosquitoes. Before the meadows were built up, you better believe the place was alive with mosquitoes. And we, all of us, broke out in blisters because of the, first of all, we had very bad screens in our house. I remember at night swarming these darn mosquitoes. But anyway, for one whole season, we had to contend with all of these bites. But that was the family coming, this family coming to America.
This is the end of tape one, side one. This is the start of tape one, side two. The house in Rutherford that you were living in, where was it?
Well, it still stands. It's on the main street, Park Avenue here, and my parents lived there until they died, and the house belongs to one of my sons now, and it's nice to see it kept in the family. He doesn't live there, but he rents it out. He happens to live in the city.
You mentioned that the other boys in the neighborhood were giving you and your brother a hard time.
Right.
Were you the only immigrant family in the neighborhood?
Oh, yes. Yes, we were really the only. This town used to be a very close-knit town, and it was sort of a blue-nosed town. People didn't talk. It took a long time in. It took a long time for us to get in to any extent, but that character has changed now.
And what did your family do for an income now that you had moved to the United States?
Well, I told you that my father was a building contractor in Wales, and he had been apprenticed when he was a young boy to an uncle of his who was a big-time contractor. And so he had learned the business from the ground up and ultimately went into business for himself. Amongst one of the things that he did, he was an ornamental plasterer, one of these people that did the fancy ornamentation of buildings and wealthy estates and so on, which was a very specialized field. So my father was in that line when he was here, but he couldn't, he found he couldn't operate by himself, so he had to work for larger firms and had become a union member. So he was restricted in some ways what he couldn't do. Now, we weren't here very long before the Great Depression set in. And my father, of course, being in the building line, found himself out of work, as did many millions of other people. We had saved money. They were very frugal with the money, so for a while they were able to carry on with the savings that they had. But there came a day when there was no money. And my father was too proud to ask for any relief. He refused to do that. And I remember one night when I was supposed to be in bed, my father and mother talking about what's going to happen the next day. There was no money and very little food in the house. And I went to school the next day with a real aching stomach because I was so worried. But a wonderful thing happened. My mother had a brother who was a single man. He had come to the United States many years before, and he was an engineer with a 20 mule team borax company in Death Valley in California. And she had written to him evidently asking for the loan of some money. And when I came home for lunch that day, a check had come for $100, which was a tremendous thing. And then my father, he couldn't meet the mortgage payments. So a lot of houses were being foreclosed right and left, and we were scared to death. I know I was, but my parents tried to keep it away from us kids, that we were going to be out on the street. My father, when he faced that situation, was really desperate. I don't know what he would have done if, in fact, this had happened. But he went to the head of the building and loan and asked if he couldn't make a deal where he would just pay the interest And in exchange for that, he would do repairs on these houses that they were foreclosing. So that arrangement was made. So I remember it was $25 a month that they had to come up with to pay the interest. So the house was kept. And then my father was able, he finally condescended in a way, although he had no other option, to get onto what they call the WPA, the Works Projects Administration. And this was something that President Roosevelt had started. It was a sort of a make-work deal where the people did whatever for, I think it was $30 a month, something like that. So my father used to go down on the meadows down here with some other men and dig drainage ditches. And they take a couple of potatoes with them and make a fire and cook the potatoes, and that's what they ate. Mm-hmm. So this episode in a person's life puts an indelible mark on one. And to talk to people of your generation, you might understand it to a certain point, but nobody can really appreciate unless you've been through the fire.
I'm sure you're right in saying that.
So then as things started to ease up a bit, my father was able to... My father, even before that, I think so much of... I think so much of my father. He would go to New York and walk up and down the streets looking for some evidence of some work going on in the building, like cement or whatever, and try to walk in to get a little job. And he'd walk the streets systematically, one street after the other, day after day after day, and come home. Nothing. That is a tremendous weight to put on somebody, you know. I didn't realize it at the time as much as I do now, but I thank him so much for having the courage to make the break that he did, and to give us the opportunity to better our lives here in this country.
Let me just ask one or two other questions. When you had first landed in New York and you said you came up to 23rd Street and you stayed at a hotel, what were your impressions of Manhattan when you landed here that first day? Or during that period?
Well, we were bewildered, of course. We were... already acclimatized to some of the things we would see, having seen postcards and whatnot of the Woolworth Building, which was the highest building, I guess, in the world at the time. So we knew what to expect, and we could see the skyline from Ellis Island. But I was told by my father to sort of keep charge of the other kids, and we never went out of the hotel that I can remember. We never wandered the street, that's for sure, you see. So did
you look out the window?
Yes, of course, we did that, but it didn't make an impression on me. I was bewildered enough and ready to... Expecting some of these things that I would see, but the excitement of the unknown, I think, in a way, counteracts any fear or apprehension that you would have of a situation. So I don't recollect being afraid at all.
And also for those the 2 weeks that you were on Ellis Island, is there anything else you can tell us about that? You said that you would go out each afternoon and play.
In the mornings and the afternoon, everyone was let out. It couldn't have been all at one time because there were too many people involved. And we were allowed out for, I would imagine, for half an hour or an hour or something like that. You know, then we'd have to go in and another group would go out. It was a relatively small area.
This was children and adults?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, everyone was let out and they get the fresh air.
You're involved with something now concerning Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty. Would you tell us about it?
All right. A few years ago, my wife and I took one of our grandchildren over to the Statue of Liberty. And I was very surprised to see some of the things that, for example, they had a museum there. And when you walked through there, there was a depiction of the history of immigrants into the country, and it was broken down into various nationalities, Germans and whatnot, and with life-size figures in some instances of people in the national dress and so on. So, being Welsh, I was interested to see something about the Welsh coming into this country because there's a very strong history of Welsh people arriving early into America and the very substantial contributions they've made to the growth of the country. I could enumerate many, many things that outstanding Welsh people have done and people who were not so outstanding. People were recruited in Wales to come over to work in the coal mines here and they settled in Pennsylvania and so on and established some towns with Welsh names and it's still there today. People were recruited from the north of Wales to work in the slate quarries up in and the marble quarries up in Vermont and New Hampshire. And so on, and many of the leaders of the War of Independence were Welsh people. The man who financed the revolution was a Welshman. But I saw nothing about this at all, and I thought that if the government was going to refurbish this exhibit, that there should be some recognition of the contribution of the Welsh people to the building of the country. So I got in contact with some influential people of Welsh origin, and as a result of that, there's an ongoing program now to have some recognition made when the new facility is open. We also, at another time, went to visit Ellis Island, and I was really very sad to see the state that it's in. It had been wrecked by vandals. There were some squatters in there for some period of time, and they all contributed to desecrating the place, if that's the correct word for such a place. We went on a tour, conducted tour through the place, my wife and I, and one of the people from the national, I don't know, one of the Smokey the Bear girls took us through, and the stories that she was telling this group was something out of this world. It was concocted by somebody with a vivid imagination, I think, and without much without much element of truth attached to it. So somewhere along the line, she invited anybody who might have been in Ellis Island to come forward and speak. So there was a man there who had come in as a baby. He knew nothing. And I spoke to them. And I recited some of the things that I've told you just before. And after that, I was mobbed by people wanting this and that and the other thing, and for me to write articles. And but when we were ready to get back on the boat, somebody from the national government, what is an organization that that conducts the tour through there? They, you know, these public park, not national park people or something like that.
National Park Service.
Yeah. Okay. These are the people. Got a hold of me and said, we would like you very much to come to the Statue of Liberty and record what you remember. I said, I'll be glad to do that. I gave them my telephone number and so on. I never heard from them. So I left it at that until I was contacted by you folks some months ago, and it seems like a happy circumstance, because I'm glad if I can contribute in some small way to your compilation of the history of the Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty. So I'm going to be real interested now next year when hopefully the statue is going to be rededicated, to see what has been done in the way of recording for future generations the contribution of the Welsh people to the country.
Thank you very much. This is the end of the interview. It's the end of side 2 of tape 1.